Good afternoon and welcome to the Senior Statesman of Virginia's May program. The Senior Statesman this year is celebrating our 25th anniversary, and we are pleased and proud to be presenting programs of import and interest to the community. And today's program is no exception, as we will host our annual General Assembly wrap-up. One very short note of housekeeping, that is that the audience will not be able to ask questions of our panelists until after they have made their opening statements, and then you may do so by going to the bottom of your screen and clicking on the Q&A section. Now it's my pleasure to introduce to you Sue Friedman, who is our vice president here at Senior Statesman, and she will both host and moderate the program today. Sue?
Welcome. Thank you so much, President Jeff, and welcome to Senior Statesmen. I am going to briefly introduce our panelists this morning, actually this afternoon, and then we'll get to opening statements. Each of our elected officials will have 4 minutes for an opening statement. First, from the Senate, we have Senator Cree Deeds, the 25th District. Welcome, Senator Deeds. And from the House, we have Delegate Rob Bell, the 58th District. Welcome, Delegate Bell. Delegate Matt Ferris from the 59th District. Delegate Sally Hudson from the 57th House District. And Delegate Chris Runyon from the 25th House District. And Delegate Ferris will be joining us momentarily. But to maximize your input and your information, we're going to start right off with the opening statements. We had a previous, if you will, drawing of the names out of the bowl. And so our order is we will start with Delegate Runyon. Welcome, Delegate Runyon, and we look forward to your opening statement.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate that, Sue. And as we were chatting beforehand, this is my second opportunity. And I want to congratulate you folks for 25 years of engagement and commitment to the Commonwealth and particularly Western Virginia. It is wonderful that we can have conversations, engagement and discussion of ideas, because I think that makes everyone's life and lives better. So thank you. Truly do appreciate you all. A couple of things about me. This is my first term, completing my first term. I live in Western Rockingham. And so by car, we're about an hour and 10 minutes to Crozet. And so that's not really bad, assuming that the roads are open and everything's working out pretty well. And I've made a number of trips over. It's quite interesting, the similarities and yet the differences between the three jurisdictions, the basic jurisdictions that I represent: Southern Rockingham, Northern Augusta, and Western Albemarle. But what I will say that in over the last 725 days or so, what I see is there's a whole lot more similarities, regardless of where we are policy issues. There's a whole lot more similarities. As I think back to some of the conversation that I had 2 years ago, one of the things that I wanted to work with was bipartisanship issues. And that's why I wanted to make sure that was included in my opening statements. You know, this was a significant session. There are significant conversations, significant policy issues, so significant input or impact on the Commonwealth. Certainly COVID was the 800-pound gorilla in the room, rebuilding the economy. And you know, certainly that still has its ups and downs. Kids back to school safely, vaccine access and distribution. And a comment on that, you know, most of the time that our office is spending is on helping constituents solve their problems. Stuff's not working real well, very effectively, and it takes our engagement. And I got to give kudos to my legislative assistant, Patrick, because every day he has multiple interactions with state agencies and constituents trying to solve things that are really critical for those folks in their lives. Couple of bills that if we have an opportunity to discuss future would be the DMAS study that we were fortunate to be able to carry in assistance with ARC of Virginia. And what it does, it's going to study the most effective ways to allow for telehealth services to folks in the DD community. And it's quite fascinating. That is a nonpartisan issue. And it's quite fascinating that we've been able to identify some of the advantages that have happened because of that, but also some of the areas that we've got to improve, i.e. broadband access. The other one was a quite interesting bill because of some changes made in the previous legislative session, concealed carry handguns permits for folks that took an online class that expired December 31st of the prior year. With COVID, people couldn't get in and get to the courthouses to complete their applications. Everything else had been done except that. And so we brought a bill forward, and it had bipartisan support as it came through the House and the Senate to extend that time period to April 30th. So we're beyond that time period anyway, but anybody that in good faith had completed that application was able then to perfect that application. And what I thought was really important about that is there was good conversation on the floor about it, but it was solved in a bipartisan manner, because what I heard from folks was it was the right thing to do. It treated people fairly, and we'd move on. So I wanted to bring that forward. We don't always fight like cats and dogs down there. So thank you. I appreciate it and look forward to our continued conversation.
Thank you, Delegate Runyon. And next in our opening statements will be Delegate Rob Bell.
Good afternoon, everyone. It's a little strange not to see the audience, but I'm going to assume that there are people watching. This is the what Cree and I have been coming for many years, and Delegate Runyon's and Hudson and Ferris have joined us. But I appreciate you doing this as a chance to sort of run through some of the topics that came up at session. I'm going to give some general comments, talk about a couple of bills, and then otherwise leave time for your questions. This was a unique session. We always say this, but this was, as the joke is going, more unique than others. In 400 years, we are the second oldest elected body in the world, the oldest in the Western Hemisphere. But the five of us have now done something that no one before us has ever done, which is have a virtual session. And the Senate and House did take different roles, but in both places, the virtual nature, like what we're doing today, was significant. And in the House, it was absolute. We had our committee meetings, our floor debate, late into the night, early in the morning, were meetings done just like this. And it's interesting. We got to see sort of how it works. I think we have a very informed view now of the things that it does better, perhaps, than in person. It is certainly easier for you all to testify. You don't have to come down to Richmond. We're already there, but you don't have to make the trip. I think there are certainly downsides. We are not as able to work through bills together. The Zoom inevitably is one person talking, everyone listening, and it's harder to add some of the, just if you ever come to our committee meetings, you will often see us working, we call it chewing on a bill, but working through a bill, usually in a nonpartisan way, just to see what's in it. That's harder to do over Zoom. And I think you can see that in the work product. I think you're going to see that. We're all hopeful we can go back next year in person and then also perhaps incorporate some of the benefits of Zoom, especially for all of our off-session meetings. We have commissions and crime commissions, and Cree Deeds has the Deeds Commission. All of those are easier for especially non-legislative members to attend through Zoom. So we might find that we keep some of the things we've learned as benefits. The other thing would be, and I say this every year, the bills that you all read about in the paper, see on TV, or perhaps even we'll talk about today, are often the highest profile bills. They often have a partisan breakdown of the votes. That is not the majority of the bills we do. Most of the bills we do, we generally pass 600 or 700 bills. All but, let's say, 50 are bills that are taken up. And they might be non-unanimous. There might be a regional split. There might be all sorts of splits, but it's not a partisan split. And most bills, if you look at the numbers, are unanimous. And that doesn't mean that they're perfect. It just means that the patrons have worked with people with criticisms and come up with a consensus. We call it peace in the valley. And those bills often, by the time they get to the floor, everybody kind of knows what's in them. There's been an effort to make them unanimous and they pass. When the membership majority changed 2 years ago, I had a bunch of questions from constituents, the press, probably some people in this room about, would it be impossible to pass any bills? Or are they going to just kill all your bills? And I said, that's Washington. That's not how it works in Richmond. And I don't want to speak for Matt or Chris, but certainly where I have bills that are not of a partisan nature, they have gotten a hearing and have even passed. And so I'm going to talk about a few of those that passed this year. And they're, as you'll see, they're not high profile bills. You probably have not heard of them or read about them, but they're bills that matter to the affected people. I was happy to get them passed. The first two are approaching the same problem through a different method. And this is the issue of, I think most of you have heard me say this in previous sessions, but I have a special needs son. He's now 18. People like him and the parents of the kids at his school are always worried about interactions with law enforcement. And the issue would be if you have a communications difficulty like autism, or even something more physical nature like a hearing loss, trying to express that to the officer to explain why you're having trouble expressing that to the officer becomes harder. And so we had two bills. The first would be that you may know this already, but you can get a driver's license or just an ID card with a designation that says, I have a difficulty communicating. And you could present that to an officer if you're having trouble kind of explaining why the problem is. The second was, this was not my idea. This was Delegate Hayes. And last year he said, well, that's great, but what we really want is to get that information to the officer before he comes up to the window. So by then, by the time it's at the window and you're reaching for your ID, by then it might already be a problem. And so he found a way to tie it to the drive, the actual license on the back of the car. And we all thought that was great, and we passed it. And then this year we looked at it, and it turns out that no one had exercised this option. And so we asked DMV what the issue was, and they said that often the special needs driver is not the owner of the car. The bill required it to be the owner. And so this year we modified that to say that the owner can designate a common driver as having special needs issues. Both of those bills were taken up. I think they were amended in committee. And by the time they got to the floor, I think most people would say, well, sure, that's a good idea. And so they both passed. I'll briefly mention one more and then pass on the mic. The other one was this issue called supported decision making. Many people need some help making decisions, but perhaps don't need a full guardian. A full guardianship is both expensive and complicated, and it foregoes all of your legal rights. A supported decision making is just someone who says, look, let's talk through this again. Maybe it's a money decision, a medical decision, and you designate that person. You don't actually give up the rights. The ward, they call them, actually keeps all those rights, but having someone designated, we think, can make it work better. This was the product of a year-round study group. We actually talked about it briefly in the Deeds Commission, and all of us thought it was a good idea, so that passed unanimously. So, Ms. Friedman, I'm happy to stop there, and I look forward to everybody's questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I am not sure Delegate Ferris has been able to join us.
Madam Chair, I have been informed by a text that he's here and muted and just wanted one of us to pass that on to you somehow. I've now done so. I'm not sure.
Great. Okay. While we're looking to give him plenty of time, we will move to opening comments from Delegate Hudson, and then we will be working behind the scenes to make sure that Delegate Ferris is next. Delegate Hudson.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for everyone for tuning in today. My name is Sally Hudson. If we haven't had a chance to meet before, I serve Charlottesville City and a good hunk of Albemarle County. And when I am not serving in the House, I am teaching at UVA. I'm an economist by trade. I teach statistics at the University of Virginia and just wrapped up the semester. So I'm excited to have an unusual school year behind us. As Delegate Bell said, my school year, my teaching was all online this year, and then also serving in the House, which, Matt, are you with us?
Yes, go ahead. I'm sorry, Sally. I didn't mean to interrupt. I just want to let them know that they found me.
Wonderful. Good to have you with us. I think you're next. we were teaching all online at UVA this year. I am looking forward to being back in the classroom with my students in the fall, but we muddled through, and we were all online in the House as well. As Delegate Bell said, that had some pros to it. It did mean that lots of folks were able to tune in from afar and make their voices heard. We do also miss being there in person with our colleagues and all of the good in-person work that facilitates. Some of the big things that we did this session that I think we should be proud of, and I hope I'm not stealing the senator's thunder here, but I'm very proud that we codified a lot of the work that we did to protect safe and secure elections in the fall last year. He deserves enormous credit for that as the chair of our elections committee on the Senate side. But as you see headlines across the country about attempts to undermine access to the ballot box here in Virginia, we've really been protecting that. And the most recent audit of our election shows that we really had a spotless record here in Virginia. So something very to be proud of as one of the birthplaces of democracy here in our country. Personally, some of the projects that I was most excited to work on that brought some of those good bipartisan coalitions that the past speakers referenced were on clean energy and also on criminal justice. We did some important work this session to shift some money from our state budget out of the coal coal industry in Southwest Virginia and toward more sustainable sources of economic and energy development. You know, as Delegate Bell said, we talk about peace in the valley sometimes in those bills. On that bill, we got peace in the mountains and got some good people together who were excited about opening up the next era of clean energy in Virginia. And so that was really exciting. As one of our younger delegates cared deeply about combating our climate crisis. And then on the criminal justice front, we worked with lots of good folks, including Delegate Bell, to try to make it easier for folks to get back on their feet after having interactions with law enforcement and, you know, potentially finding themselves incarcerated. A lot of times people, after they're released, need to find housing and find jobs, get a stable economic future, and court debt, criminal debt can make it hard for them to do that. And so we started reforming our system of fines and fees here in the Commonwealth in a way that will make it, I think, a little easier and a little fairer for folks to focus on getting their feet under them before they start paying back those debts. So that's work that I'm excited about. I'm excited about making sure that everyone in Virginia has those second chances and a real chance to thrive after involvement with the justice system. And so those are two things that I was excited to help spearhead and look forward to your questions today.
Thank you so much, Delegate Hudson. And now via phone, potentially via video soon, we'll see what we can do about that. We have Delegate Ferris for his opening comments. Thank you, Delegate Ferris.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate y'all putting this together, and I appreciate everybody attending today. Like some of the previous presenters have talked about, we've learned a lot in this special, unique session. We learned how to do what we're doing today, and that works great for a lot of things, but sometimes it doesn't work great. I know in previous years in session, I really prided myself in being able to work things out, bipartisan deals, and even put groups or people that were against one another together and hammer out some differences. And it's hard to do when you're not looking at one another. You can't get in a huddle. You can't shut a door and talk to one another. It was really tough for me this year because I'm a people person. I like to sit down and look at somebody and talk to them and visit with them, talk to them about their family and all. It's just the way I am, and it gets when we're on this doing session like we did this year, is really distance from one another. And you know, Delegate Hudson and I have served together for 2 years. We've been neighbors, and we hadn't spent hardly any time together. And I feel like she's a very lovely person, and I'd love to spend more time with her. And in previous sessions, we would have. We've got to talk and visit. But that was the most difficult thing for me this session, was just not being able to interact in the way we have been interacting. I think we had a very busy session. A lot of legislation was passed. I really hope that we didn't go too far with some of our legislation. I don't necessarily disagree with the path that some of the legislation that we passed this year was on. I just hope we didn't go too far down that path. It one juncture without making sure we were doing things right. But that's what happens when the party that you're in is not in control. You don't get to make those decisions. But we had all in all, I think we had a good budget. I voted for the budget. It had a lot of good things in it. Had a lot of things I didn't agree with, but there was so many things that I did agree with that were good for the state, good for the workers. I just felt like that the staff had done such a wonderful job working on the budget, and the committee had worked hard on it. Even though I understand why some didn't vote favorably on the budget, I just felt like I had, because I'd worked so close with the staff and getting that done. But it'll be interesting times for sure. The next 6 months is as we go into campaign season, and I look forward to doing that, and look forward to visit today and answering any questions the best I can. Thank y'all for having me.
Thank you so much, Delegate Ferris. And to round out our opening comments, our Senator Creed Deeds.
Thank you so much. And thank you for letting me go last and hear what everybody else has to say, which kind of gives me a path. I don't know how many issues I need to talk about during the session that finished, because a lot of it's been reported and my colleagues from the House have talked about some of the issues. I want to first thank you for, as Rob says, we've been coming to this event for many years. I miss not being on Pepsi Place with you, with a room full of people and a lot of questions. And we've had a lot of fun together, but we'll have fun again. I'm confident of that. We'll get back to normal. We'll get back to the in-person events before long. What there are two big issues, of course, that during the session that probably don't need to be talked about: abolishing the death penalty, legalizing the possession of marijuana on July 1 for adults. We can talk about that in the question and answer. A lot of the other issues have been talked about. We did some significant things with election law, but I want to talk about in general what we learned. You know, one of the troubling things over the years has been, you know, a lot of people have a cynical view of the process and a cynical view of lobbyists. And of course, lobbyists are a necessary part of the process. They educate you. You know, in a legislative session, you have to deal with lots of issues. And, you know, sometimes you're always operating, or at least for me, I'm operating on the best information available. I might not have the best information. In a perfect world, you have good lobbyists on either side of every issue. Of course, we don't live in a perfect world, and you don't have that every situation. But the influence of lobbyists is pervasive through the process. With this year, even though the Senate met in person, lobbyists didn't have any more access to legislators than anybody else. That was so refreshing. And the committee rooms, we were in the committee room, and everybody that wanted to testify appeared virtually. No one had more time than anybody else. And whether you were sitting at your computer screen in Abington or Big Stone Gap or Arlington or Charlottesville or Virginia Beach or Accomack, you had the exact same access. You didn't have to pick up your things and go to Richmond and take a day off and sit in traffic or travel 2 or 3 hours or 4 hours or more to engage in the process. And that was refreshing. You know, this legislative session, one of the things we did, both the House and the Senate had the most restrictive bill limits we've ever had, at least in the time I've been there. I think the senators could only introduce 12 bills. The House members could introduce 7. As chairman of the Privilege and Elections Committee, I had to introduce a bunch more bills on the part of the governor. But we still had extreme limits. They still, during this session, the days were longer and harder, I think, than any I ever remember. You know, we were constantly at work. I hope we can continue. We keep the Zoom part of the process available so that people don't have to travel to Richmond, so that people can participate in the process. I don't know how to keep the other side, the lobbyists, at an arm's length down the road. I don't know how to limit that, but it was refreshing, at least for one session. You know, I want to talk a little bit about some things, some unfinished business, because we will have at least one, maybe two special sessions between now and the election. Number one, you know, and this has been reported, we'll get $4.3 billion and spending almost $7 billion total, but $4.3 billion that will come to the state as a result of the federal election in January. We had some direction from the federal government this week on how to spend that money, but that will be ultimately be up to the General Assembly, and we'll have to go back in the session to figure out what how that money is going to be allotted. The second thing we'll have to do for in a special session is deal with the Court of Appeals. Now, during this session, there was significant legislation that reformed the jurisdictional controls of the court and also expanded the court. The bill ultimately was a recommendation of the Judicial Council of the Supreme Court. It does more than just add justices. It adds work to the Court of Appeals. I think it makes the Court of Appeals gives them a real role in the judicial system. But as a result of that, we'll have to add 7 new members to the court. That will have to occur this summer too. The third thing that we'll have to deal with is redistricting. You know, in the past, the legislature has done we've drawn the lines. Once we got the information from the Census Bureau, from the federal government. Well, last year, the census was somewhat mishandled. The pandemic certainly added to the problems they were having. We've been delayed in getting information about where everybody is. You know, we've also got an independent commission that does it now. Part of the independent commission is made up of legislators, but that independent commission will get the information, probably all of it, sometime in August or by August. They'll make recommendations to the General Assembly, and we will have to vote their plan up or down sometime probably in September. So I would guess that we'll be in session for at least a few days in August and a few days in September, but that could change. So I look forward to your questions. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. I want to compliment all of our valued elected officials. You know about 4 minutes. So we really appreciate that. Delegate Ferris, since we can't see you, if you have a response and we don't specifically call on you, just interrupt me, if you will. We do have a couple of questions to begin, and let me tell our nearly 70 participants so far, if you have a question, go to the Q&A. It says Q&A. It's just to the right of the participant number at the very bottom of your Zoom screen. So if you'll go there and type in your question, we will make sure that we take every opportunity to have it answered between now and 3 p.m. So the first question was specifically for Delegate Hudson. I suspect we may have others who would like to also mention that. And the question is, how do you involve the minority to collaborate at the General Assembly?
Well, I think the two bills that I just highlighted in my earlier remarks are a great example. I think that I'm fortunate to have senior mentors in both parties. I think particularly on both of those topics, when it has come to both energy and criminal justice work, Delegate Bell, you know, in particular, brings a tremendous wealth of information and experience in his long service on the courts committee, and has always been very generous in working on that. I found also another neighbor of ours who's not here today is Delegate Ware, who serves the Louisa area. And he's been a wonderful partner to me on energy reform and consumer protection work, and also as a member of the Finance Committee. I've found fortunate. I think we really have a wonderful contingent in Central Virginia of really talented and collaborative legislators. And so I felt fortunate, especially as a junior member, to find those mentors quickly.
Anyone else like to comment on collaborating with the minority?
Let me just say that in the Senate, it's only 21 to 19, 21 Democrats and 19 Republicans. And believe it or not, the 21 Democrats don't always agree 100% on everything. So to get things done, we have to work together, or we have to find a way to work alone. But to get things done ultimately in the Senate on almost any issue, you've got to find a way to work together.
Sue, Ms. Friedman.
I say you can call me Sue.
That's okay. Madam Chair is what we're used to, or even Madam Speaker in the House. I think that this is where I would ask everybody in the audience, raise your hand if you've ever come down to Richmond. We can't do that, which is too bad. But my observation has been, and again, let's take aside the out of 700 bills, whatever the number is, 50 that are generally breaking on partisan lines. But for all the rest of them, my observation has been that you have people who have some subject matter expertise around a table. And so I've been on the health committee for, I guess, my whole tenure, and I'm not a doctor. And on that committee over the years, we've had doctors, we've had a chiropractor, we've had nurses, we've had an optometrist, and inevitably they have an expertise on the subject that the rest of us don't have. And if you, especially in the House subcommittees, we're bigger, so the big committees have 22 people, but the subcommittees have 8, 9, 10. That's similar to the Senate committees. But what visitors are always surprised at is the informality of it. I remember we had a bill, oh goodness, 15 years ago, and it was brought to me by a UVA doctor. And what happened is we kept editing it and then asking her to stand up and explain whether it was a good idea or bad idea. And finally, the chairman, I think it was, it doesn't matter, Jean Marie Devilites, said, let's just have her sit literally at the table with us. Now, I don't mean a metaphorical table. I mean, she pulled up a chair and sat down because it was silly for us to keep doing something, ask her to come to the podium, sit back down, get up and sit back down. I think that, again, for those bills that are going to end up passing 95-5 or 100-0, it's not that it's casual, it's that it's informal and that we are given a chance at least to say our piece before the bills are sort of taken up. Thank you.
Okay. If there's no other comments on Delegate Runyon, please.
Thank you. It's too slow on my mouse there, but I'd like to comment as a perspective from a member of the minority, and I really do appreciate this question. As I think back, you know, there were a number of bills that I worked hard to have a bipartisan relationship when the bill was filed. The solar redefinition of agritourism or agritourism relating to expansion of solar. Delegate Murphy and I worked together on that with a couple of the cooperative energy companies. And so there's a great example of that. Already mentioned the concealed carry was bipartisan. We carried a bill at the request of the Civil War Battlefields Preservation Association that deals with preservation of relics. And there were a number of folks on the other side of the aisle that were very supportive of that. Something that's not particularly legislative, but we've been doing it for a couple of years, Delegate Shelley Simons, who's from the Norfolk Tidewater area, she and I figured, we're both freshmen, we figured out that we had an interest in career and technical education. And she comes at it from maybe a different perspective than I do, but the ultimate goal is, how do we enhance career and technical education, improve the delivery of those, modernize the systems as necessary? So Shelley and I formed the Career and Technical Education Caucus. And so we meet routinely. We're meeting virtually this summer. We had a really interesting meeting with the Department of Corrections folks on how do they teach career and technical education in an incarcerated circumstance. And so I've been very pleased with that. And one thing that I'll tell you, that when I go out and talk to constituents, and I tell them that story, you can see it in their eyes that they say, yeah, that's what we're sending you there for. Let's solve problems and let's figure out how to get those problems solved collaboratively so it benefits all the Commonwealth. And so I'm very proud that I had the opportunity to work with Shelley and the rest of the members on that caucus. Thank you so much.
And just so that we don't overlook you, Delegate Ferris, any comment on this?
Well, yes, I wanted to say, I guess everybody else has got their piece. I'll go ahead and say, you know, this year when we were talking about some renewable energy things, I called Sally, and Sally said, well, she gave me her thoughts, and she said, I'll tell you, somebody else has got some interesting thoughts on this subject, and she gave me their number. Of course, it was in their caucus, and we visited, and probably the single thing that I enjoy besides meeting so many people and is the wealth of knowledge in the General Assembly. When you bring on the House side 100 people from all different aspects and walks of life, we learn so much from one another. Then you go over to the Senate and it's 40 people there that come from different walks of life. And it's just very interesting. You sometimes you think that you have something figured out and somebody will bring up something you never thought of. And it's a very, very learning experience, and it's really been interesting and I'd have to say fun working with, when we were in a majority, working with the minority, and when we're in a minority, working with the majority to try to come to understand, if not compromise, on legislation.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Well, we now have three questions that have come in. So the next one is it time to rescind the state of emergency? So I'm going to randomly start with Delegate Bell.
Well, I certainly hope we can see the end from here. I think that we're all seeing that the daily COVID counts are lower and lower. Vaccination rates are up. I've been vaccinated. I would encourage everybody to be vaccinated. Altamaha County has, I think I saw, the highest vaccination rate in the state. And I think that there has been there are impacts of the various laws that are hard to even see as they've gone on. And Sally spoke about the difference over at UVA. Of course, everybody, the schools have had enormous impacts. And so I would hope that if we're not there yet, we can get there. These are I think most people understand these are orders that come from the executive branch, the executive orders. And so perhaps the governor is consulting with Senator Deeds and Delegate Hudson, but he's not running this past us for a hands up or not. But that would be the step. It would be up to the governor. And as he issues additional executive orders, we've seen loosening of restrictions. And I think we're all hopeful we can get to the end pretty soon.
You know, if the governor is consulting with legislators, I'm not among them. But I'm not going to criticize his use of the emergency order in this situation. We've been through something, and I hope we're close to the end, but I don't think we're there yet. We've been through something that nobody alive has been through. This pandemic is just what it has done to our society is quite remarkable. What it could have done is even worse. And when you look at what's going on around the world, based on what was going around the country, I think it's proven that the governor and his administration made some good decisions last year. I'm hopeful that we can end the emergency order soon, but I'm not ready to call it quite yet. I think we've got to get the vaccination rates up. And we've still got some more work to do, but I'm confident that it can end soon. I think that I read somewhere that he's going to make further announcements toward the middle of June, and I think we're going to see society turn more and more, reopen more and more. You know, and candidly, you know, I live in Bath County. And our biggest employer here is the Homestead Hotel. The Homestead Hotel last year overnight went from 800 employees to 45 employees. 800 employees to 45 employees. In a county of 4,600, that has an enormous impact. It's only the relief that's come in the way of federal unemployment dollars that's kept many of these people alive. The summer camps, another big part of our economy, completely shut down last year. I think we were the only state in the country to do that. Did we make the right decision? I don't know. I'm not gonna second guess that decision. I'm hopeful that we can end the emergency order soon.
Yeah, I would just echo what the senator said, which is that I think the governor has said that if case rates keep going down and vaccine rates keep going up, then by the middle of June that we could have our sights set on lifting all of the existing restrictions. The other thing that I would add is that though cases are down, the thing we have learned about COVID is that it can take off like a rocket. And so it's important to reduce cases, but really to drive them all the way down to zero if we can, because if it does start to pick up again, it can pick up very quickly, as we've seen in some parts of the country that have had outbreaks. You know, in UVA, we had a real burst in that happened in after one or two big communal events. Of course, we've seen other countries in the world like India just have their case rates spiral like that. So just a good reminder that while case rates are going down, what we really want to do is get them down to zero so they can't pick up again.
Thank you. Anyone else on the state of emergency? Delegate Runyon?
Yeah, I concur. I think we're much closer than certainly we have been. And I see that in our citizens. They are anxious to be able to get back to whatever the new normal is going to be. And I agree also that we need to continue to vaccinate folks. My wife and I have been vaccinated. Many folks around us have. I think there's still some concerns with folks on how the vaccine rollout went and the efficacy and the safety of it. I will say that I'm encouraged. I know that over in the Valley, there were a number of folks in the medical community, the nursing community, that were unsure at the beginning, and their numbers of receiving the vaccine were lower than many other groups. Those numbers, I'm being told now, are starting to come up. So I think that's an encouraging sign. People put a lot of trust and confidence in the nursing community, and as they then become more vaccinated, I think we'll have some of those folks that are less willing or less likely to be vaccinated right now. They're more likely to change their mind. And so, it's certainly up to the governor when he does that. I would encourage us to move forward more quickly. I think as people get back to normal, the economy can get back to normal. There's a lot of disruptions in the economy right now, some of which are caused because we're still in this emergency situation. I think people are looking for leadership and confidence in those pronouncements. So thank you.
Thank you. Delegate Ferris, any comment?
All right. I really like being able to have the last word. But, you know, really and truly, I'm going to say that in the beginning, I didn't take this as serious as I should have. I think a lot of people were that away. But I think at this point, everyone understands how serious this is. And today at lunchtime, I was so proud to we had a parade around Central Hospital there in Lynchburg, both hospitals. Just had a parade to say thank you to the healthcare workers. And at the meeting point, there was a lot of people had their mask on. And there was one of the administrative staff there. He knew I'd had my shots. I knew he'd had his shots. But when we saw one another, we hugged one another, just like we always had, and neither one of us had our mask on. I think that the people in my district at least know this is serious, are taking it serious, taking the precautions they need to take, and they're smart enough to start making some of these decisions on their own. And the governor's, I think ABC stores, they've talked like Friday they were going to turn the ABC stores back to their normal hours. And I think it'd be a great time to go ahead and do that for everybody else.
Thank you. Our next question, and I'm going to allow everyone to have the first chance at the question. So this one will start with Delegate Runyon, is how can we in the 5th Congressional District get representation on the Redistricting Commission? If you'll unmute for us, Delegate Runyon.
Thank you. I apologize. So I appreciate the question. And of course, the commission is currently set, and there was an application process. And I think both sides of the aisle had opportunity to present people, both the elected officials and then We, I think we're allowed to submit a significant number of names, and then the panel of judges chose those. So in the short answer would be apply, apply, apply. Now, you know, we're going to have to go through the next cycle to do that. I do notice, and I think it's One Virginia that's doing a real nice job in sending out emails and information about that and encouraging people to follow the Zoom meetings that are had, the records being presented, and participate in as high level as you can. It's much like Delegate Bell said earlier, it's become more easy to testify now. We don't have to drive to a central location. We can do this electronically. The challenge, I think, is letting people understand and know what's available out there.
Okay. Anyone else on getting 5th District representation on the redistricting?
Yeah. I'll just say that Chris Runyon's exactly right. The commission's been chosen. Under the constitutional amendment and the statutes that have been passed under it, there was a process for us to choosing the members of the commission, and people applied, and then the political leadership of both parties and both houses chose the people that went on that commission. So that's been done. The thing to do is just try again next time. You know, I wish we had better geographic representation on the commission, but, you know, I don't know how to fix it this time around.
And I would just add that I do think that the citizen commissioners who were selected have been very proactive about wanting citizen engagement and about scheduling more meetings than the amendment requires that they will. So there will be lots of opportunities for people from communities all up and down the 5th to testify about what's important to you as we draw the district lines. So while the commission may be locked, there are still many opportunities to make your voice heard.
Sue.
Yes, sir.
This is always one of those questions where I find that a fourth of the people know everything and three-fourths are puzzled by what we've been talking about. So just if I could have 60 seconds just to tell everyone what we're all getting at. It's this last cycle, every 10 years we have to redistrict because the population changes because of the census. This year's census was delayed, as Senator Deeds indicated earlier, because of COVID and other reasons. In any case, it didn't get done by this year. And so for this year, 2021, we will be running on the lines we have had for the previous 10 years. However, by 2022, there will be new lines. And what everybody's talking about is there was a 16-member commission that was passed as part of the redistricting amendment that everybody voted on for or against, but everybody voted on last fall. That's now part of the Constitution, and it's going to take place. And what there will be a series of meetings. There's four House, four Senate, and then 8 citizen members on this commission, and they will be drawing the lines. However, in what Chris, I think all three people preceding me have said, the commission members have been chosen, but the map has not been drawn. Members of the public are open and welcome to give their feedback in two ways. One would be, what should you generally consider? And so some people may think that competitiveness is the most important thing. Others may think that you should keep counties together. Others will say communities of interest. There's all sorts of compactness. And then the second would be a more specific, I think that, whatever it might be. And I don't want to speak for the commissioners. I'm not one of them. When we say we're going to draw the lines, it's actually the opposite. They're going to draw the lines and we get an up-down vote. But I share Sally's thoughts that they have certainly asked for feedback. And you could, I think, give very complicated feedback citing court cases, or you could just say, I think Flavanna County is too small to have two delegates. And I think that the commission would probably welcome both of those kinds of feedback. Thank you.
Okay. And of course, Delegate Ferris.
Well, thank you so much. The question was getting representation in the 5th District. And sure, we'd love to have all the representation we can from the 5th District, but the whole purpose of this was for it to be a commission that we couldn't control, and that's the way, excuse my, the way I put this, but this is just the way the cookie crumbled this time. Next time, maybe we'll be overrepresented. Represented, have more representatives from this area. But I think that's something that we do give up in this process, whether good or bad, we'll have to see how it all works out in the end. But again, I think that they'll welcome any input. And I know that the members that the Republican caucus put on are very fair, honest players, and I think they'll do a great job of making sure that this is done in a fair way. And I look forward to seeing what my new district may look like.
Okay, thank you. Now we're going to move to a different topic, and I'm going to ask Delegate Hudson to start a conversation on what is your position on funding for passenger rail?
I'm all aboard. Can I say that? I think it's great. I think especially for our community here in the Blue Ridge. I know we've got exciting news about the rail going down to the New River Valley. I know a lot of us would be excited to see the spur that we have one day been promised that would go from the Charlottesville area into Richmond. A lot of the bottleneck is about the pipeline of trains that can go all the way up to D.C., that the bridges up there end up kind of backing up into the train system all throughout Virginia. But there has been now major investment from the federal government in some of those big projects that have been stalling. So I think it's very exciting. And I think especially for the smaller and mid-sized cities in and around Virginia, it could be a real game changer for the kind of economic development that we could see. So very excited to see those investments finally come in play.
Thank you. And now, Delegate Ferris, you're not going to go last on this question. You're going to go second.
Okay. Well, that's good. I got a it's very this is a very unique topic to me, because what got me interested in politics was a train trip that I took with my wife and two oldest sons to Washington, D.C., to meet with the congressman about agricultural issues, really with the Livestock Market Association. And so we took a train out of Lynchburg and went to D.C. and stayed a couple days and came back. And on the trip back, my political interest had really been sparked, and who else would be on a train but Shining Valentine? And so she and I got to spend some time together on a train coming back. And that was the start of my political interest. And I certainly think that it's a very welcoming way to travel. And again, it's just something that's going to have to be coordinated and figured out, that so we can make it work for everybody. But I think with the fuel shortages we're seeing right now in Central Virginia, a train might be really welcome.
Thank you. Well said. Delegate Bell?
Yeah, I think probably Cree and I might be the only ones old enough to have taken trains to college, and I did. I took it to the Amtrak station on Main Street back when that was a common way to get down from Northern Virginia. I think that it's what we call a tool in the toolbox. And what I mean by that is it is an important mode of transportation. It is especially important for obviously freight. If you're going from one place to another, and both are, on the line, and it's better than many other options. Now it has the disadvantages. And so I was recently chatting with a person who took the train, and I'm going to get the details wrong, but from somewhere in the Midwest to Richmond, and to Hampton Roads. And the only way to connect the various pieces of this, where she took the train to Charlottesville, and then they had to provide a transportation to Richmond where she could pick up the other train. At some point, it becomes so complicated that you lose some of the benefits, both in terms of cost and fuel and the rest. But it's certainly a valuable tool in the toolbox. It's exciting for a place like Charlottesville to have a station that you can and I forget the times, but I've looked at them. You can get on the train and be in DC in time to go do meetings. And then they've got a train that comes back in the evening. And with Uber and the other choices we have now, it didn't used to be an option. You have to drive or not, maybe take a bus. This is another way that we can travel. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Delegate Runyon.
Thank you. I appreciate this. It's interesting, the number of us that have had personal experiences on the train over the last several years. My wife and I have traveled to both Philadelphia and New York City several times on the train out of Charlottesville. And we tried to go to Boston, and you can't really get to Boston where we needed to go anyway on the train. So all in that time frame, we're having wonderful trips up and down the East Coast on the train. And we had, let's say, a less than a satisfying airplane trip to Boston. So I'm a big proponent of it. It's quite exciting if you walk through the Blue Ridge Tunnel, the tunnel there in Afton Mountain, and you see the number of folks that are really enjoying that. And then you know that that rail line that goes right beside it runs out to Stanton and then on out to Covington and all, that the state has acquired that. And so you see a whole lot of opportunities and possibilities, an improvement and expansion of passenger service, an improvement and expansion of the economic side, the freight carrying side. You know, the Valley is very dependent on rail transportation to support our basic agricultural industries. And so those things all tie together. The train, you know, there's several things that I like about the passenger service. And I've come around to this over the last decade or so. In the 80s, I had a very negative experience taking the train into the Southeast a number of times. But again, the experience we've had over the last few years is wonderful. It provides flexibility, the environmental aspect of it, very sensitive to the environment, and the tourism component of it. When we got on the platform the last time at Charlottesville, there were probably 200 people that were going up north for various places. And I thought, man, isn't that wonderful? Those folks aren't going to be on the interstate. They're not going to be driving their cars up and down the road, and they're going to be able to utilize the time on the train for whatever purposes they want. So I was excited to hear about that. I'm excited to know that we're expanding on into the New River Valley as, you know, part of our district is on 81. And so I see the Radford and the Tech and the Lexington area school students up and down the road. And if we can provide them a safer, more effective alternative, then that's going to help every one of us. So whoever asked that question, I applaud you for thinking about it.
Yes, and I know who did.
Oh, good.
And finally, Senator Deeds, your thoughts on rail.
The only thing I can say is that the ditto to what everybody else said. You know, when I have any business in from Washington north in the Northeast corridor, I come to Charlottesville and take the train. And unlike Delegate Bell, I'm old enough to remember when CNO carried people, and I've been all over the place in CNO trains. And Delegate Runyon, I would say to you, envision this. A scenic train takes off from Hanover County, comes to Gordonsville, then down to Charlottesville, then over to Stanton, then to Clifton Forge. That's coming your way soon, my friend. We've got real opportunities to enhance our economy and also make our environment cleaner with passenger rail. I'm all for it.
Thank you so much. And Delegate Ferris, I'm going to start with you on this question, and I'm going to paraphrase it. A woman has asked, as a parent of a middle schooler who is learning about the challenges of substance abuse, how does this recent legislation involving marijuana, what does that mean for future education of young people as we try to help them make healthy decisions and avoid substance abuse?
Well, thank you very much for asking that question, because I have a son that is 16 years old. He's soon to get his driver's license. He has his learner's permit now. And we've been having some of these discussions. And it certainly adds a different narrative to our discussions. I think as it obviously has become legal or will become legal soon, it's something that he'll be around more than maybe he would have been around before. And what I've tried to stress to him, and that was my biggest problem with this legislation, is the message we were sending to our young folks. You know, I know a lot of people that seem to be able to handle marijuana use, and I suppose that they're functioning okay. But I also know of a lot of people that it affected, has affected, and still is affecting very negatively because of their abuse and their inability to handle it. And marijuana today is so much stronger, from what I understand, than what it used to be. It's different ones lace it with different stuff. And maybe when it becomes legal and you buy something that's legal out of a store, that will be more regulated and you'll know what you're using. But today it just scares me to think of my teenage son and his older brother and his younger brother, what they could see in the upcoming years when it comes to drug use and what it does to people. Something I've always discussed with my boys, and that's really scary about marijuana is what effects it has on you, as far as driving and doing things, when you're out in public, just the safety aspects to it. And I think it's just so many unanswered questions, like the ones that I'm bringing about now, that really surprised me that the governor and the legislature moved as fast as they did on this, without studying more what's happened in other states. It's something I certainly wasn't prepared for, and I sure hope the state of Virginia is prepared for, but I really have cause to pause at this time.
Thank you, Delegate Ferris. Delegate Hudson?
Sure. So let's talk a little bit about what the bill does. On July 1st, the bill would repeal the civil penalty for simple possession of cannabis. What that means is that right now you get a ticket for $25 if you're caught with a small amount of marijuana on you. And that ticket will disappear in July 1st of this year. If you live in Charlottesville City, you have already been living in that world for the last year, and you may not know it. The city of Charlottesville has not processed a single one of those tickets since Virginia decriminalized marijuana last July, when we moved it from jail time to a civil penalty. So if you're currently living in Charlottesville City and you haven't noticed a major change in access to cannabis, you might have a sneak peek at what the rest of Virginia is going to experience. Now, the bill also lays out a framework for how we will regulate the commercial sale of cannabis over the next 3 years. And there are some really important provisions of that as well that will also address some of Delegate Ferris's concerns. In particular, the bill establishes a public health advisory council, which will have veto power over any regulations that are found to have important implications for health, especially the health of youth. So in the legislation, we are putting front and center health concerns, because what we want to do is take very seriously the health of our young people. I think we know that young people, teens and older adolescents, abuse alcohol, and that alcohol being legal or not doesn't change that. It's really about the education around responsible consumption. So I think that's what we're trying to do with marijuana as well, is move toward a framework where we teach people about how to consume responsibly if they choose, and recognizing that those very serious criminal penalties aren't achieving that goal otherwise. I would also highlight, and I'm afraid I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but perhaps the senator might, as a member of the Finance Committee, that the governor added even more money in the bill during the reconvene session for the express purpose of education and health programming for youth, recognizing that it needs to be a top priority. As a pediatrician himself, I know that was very important to him as we passed the bill. So all that's just to say that if you currently don't use cannabis, you probably won't notice much of a change on July 1st. And I don't think we should expect that to be a sea change for a lot of people. What will happen on July 1st that I think is really important is that we will start the process of establishing a system for expunging past criminal convictions for small possession of marijuana, because there's a lot of people with that mark on their record who are having a hard time finding jobs and housing and credit in a way that doesn't give them a fresh chance for something that is about to be legal for everybody. So I care deeply about the health and the education of our youth, you know, someone who teaches college students, but I'm not terribly concerned that we are underestimating the importance of addressing that as we take these steps forward.
Okay, thank you. And Senator Deese, she alluded to you, so maybe you want to have follow-up there?
I don't have the number rolling off my head, but I know that the question is good and one that we've thought about. And some more money was put into the budget this year for education. Let's talk about the bill a little bit. You know, I came around to this bill after a while, and it was in one of my subcommittees. I was chairing a subcommittee, and because the jurisdictions where I practice law a long time, and I know jail is a possibility, but very, very seldom have I ever seen a jail sentence issued for someone simply in possession of marijuana. When we decriminalized it last year, I thought we'd taken care of a lot of the problem because, like Charlottesville, a lot of the jurisdictions I practice in haven't been writing tickets. I asked the executive secretary of the Supreme Court, asked someone from that person's office, how many civil violations had been written over from July 1 last year to December 31. 4,500 tickets had been written. 52% of those tickets were written for African Americans. African Americans don't use marijuana at a greater rate than Caucasians or any other group, but they only constitute 22% of our population. That's why July 1, marijuana possession, simple possession, will be legal. The rest of the bill, the framework that Sally talked about, articulately talked about correctly, I think, for the most part, has to be reenacted in the next session. And that's because I think, as Matt Ferris pointed out, the bill is so complicated. The issues are so complex that we've got to make sure we get them right. And so this is going to be an issue that's going to take a lot of work between now and next January, and we'll be heavily involved in during the next session.
Thank you. Delegate Runyon?
Thank you. You know, it's interesting to hear all the conversations about this, and you know, we're going to land on some things and some areas we're not. Overall, I believe we've way ahead of our skis on policy versus science, and that concerns me a lot. I think some of the states that have had cannabis legalization for several years, there's some lessons to be learned from that. And to be frank about it, I think we rushed through an 8,000-line bill, about 200,000 words, pretty quickly. And so I appreciate the senator's comments that it is going to come back in front of the assembly to address those. And I appreciate Sally's comments, the delegates' comments, that we have frameworks in to deal with that. But my concern is that we have maybe a framework, but we didn't put enough meat on the muscle. I believe I'm correct in that the governor put $1 million for education into the bill. I think that's woefully inadequate. As someone pointed out, you know, we have many youth that ignore the laws on alcohol or many other areas of their lives that are harmful to them. And so I think we've got to recognize this potential severity of the problem, and we're going to have to commit significantly more resources to do this, or to address those. I would have rather seen us wait and really have a well-vetted, complete and full discussion over this and then address these issues in that fashion, as opposed to, I kind of felt like that we were rushing the train down the track too quickly. It is quite interesting, since the bill passed, this is one of the top areas of concern that we've had constituents reach out to us, both formally in emails, but also when you're at the grocery store, or you're at the gas station, and it's grandmas and it's moms, and it's, to be honest with you, it's youth. Are questioning, you know, what are we doing? Why are we doing this? Do you really understand the implications that we believe it's going to be on our family? And so I think that should give us pause. So, you know, to go back, I'm concerned that we really are offering window dressing relating to how are we going to manage the risk out there. I think, yeah, looking at my notes, I think that's probably all that to say on this one. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's a great question.
Yes. Delegate Bell?
I'm smiling at something Chris said, that there are in fact issues we're not all absolutely in agreement on. And I actually had a text from somebody said, is there anything you all don't agree on? So here's one of them. I think that I'm going to do some of what Cree did, which is, let's look at the law and what the law was. So prior to this passing, over the last 2 years, Virginia law had been changing, and had been changing in a couple of clear directions. One would be that it would be marijuana was and would be illegal, but was not being treated like what we call the harder drugs, the cocaine, the meth, the heroin. And so the penalties were lower. We had a first offender program, so it was the first time through you could in fact, this was routinely granted in courts, that you would not have a conviction on your record. There was even reduced penalties for people that distributed marijuana. That was the law 2 years ago. And then last year, they changed the law to be a $25 civil penalty. And that change said that it's still not something that we think is a good thing. It's not something we encourage. But we're not going to give you even the potential jail sentence, although, as Senator Deed said, that's not something that we see commonly in court. The other thing you'd seen was a steady movement in this, both was back when Republicans were in the majority, and since then, was a recognition of some additional value of marijuana. And so in terms of the using it for medical purposes, Virginia had not gone as far as some states, but actually was about as far as you can go and still be consistent with federal law. Some of the states just did it, not caring about that. But we had issues with CBD oil and some other action to make it medicinal. This is the big step, and this is a step I think a lot of laws we pass have a long-term effect or affect some people, but I suspect this will be one come July 1st that's going to be instantaneous and statewide, because what the law says is that simple possession, meaning you're not dealing it, but simple possession of up to a pound is maximum $25 civil penalty, in a small amount is no penalty at all. And there's, everyone else has already spoken, but I do think there's some issues that we had flagged over the years, and at various times people had said, even proponents said, well, we really can't legalize it until we get these addressed. And eventually the advocates and momentum behind it passed the bill, even notwithstanding those problems. I want to identify them. The first is this issue of driving under the influence of drugs. The states that have easy legal marijuana have had a higher DUID rate. I'm not identifying the cause and effect. I'm simply saying that they have had some issues with that. The problem is we have a well-developed 25-year, 40-year probably, case law on how we handle DUIs. The tests are well-known. You have a breath test that the police have in their car. You don't have to draw blood. We have breathalyzers at the jails. None of that is available for marijuana. We're talking about a blood draw. And beyond that, there are well-accepted blood alcohol levels in terms of dangerousness. They're in the Code of Virginia. We had a local case here in Charlottesville that was pretty well known, where there was an allegation of marijuana use. And it was the gentleman who ran his truck into the train, if you remember, got up on the tracks and didn't get it off in time. And the local court concluded that even after hearing the experts, he was not comfortable understanding that a certain blood level of marijuana was sufficient to show intoxication and impairment. That's an issue, and it's going to be very hard, much harder to prosecute these cases, notwithstanding the efforts to try to come up with a backstop, than alcohol cases. The second is something Matt identified, Delegate Ferris said, which is that if there are some people in the senior statesmen who experimented in their 20s, the marijuana today is very different than what you saw in the 60s and 70s. The just the THC level is a lot higher. And the third is there's an issue that we are seeing in other states with regards to the, it's not simply marijuana that is being smoked. There are various kinds of edibles, including many that, if not intended to target children, certainly are appealing to children. We read about gummy bears and things like that. I understand that there is hope that some of the new regulatory regime will be able to take care of that. But we kind of hit the gas a few weeks ago. And what happened was the original bill by Delegate Herring was explicitly going to take a couple of years to put in place. And again, the people that were in favor of this said, we've gotten so close, we're not willing to wait. And so now it's going to be July 1st. Again, I didn't support it. I didn't vote for it. So I wasn't sort of in a position to say this far, but not that far. But I do think those are issues we're going to see come July 1st. Thank you.
Thank you. And I see Senator Creed.
I just want to hit on a couple of points, because I think there's plenty of room to agree to disagree on some of these things and not be unfriendly about it. You know, in the last few years, I've had a number of people that are very close to me that have died from alcoholism, long-term alcohol or tobacco use. Marijuana does not have the effects of tobacco or alcohol. And I don't think the impact is going to be as severe as a lot of people have pointed out. I think Rob is exactly right about the DUI issue. But my friend Patrick Kennedy, who works very hard on substance abuse issues nationally, is very concerned about this legislation. I don't think it's as simple as we want it to be. But I don't think that the people that are real concerned about it have as much to be concerned about. I think what Sally Hudson said is exactly right. For a lot of people, we're not going to see much change. We're not going to notice much. We're not going to know much difference.
Sue, one piece. I think the other piece is that I think a lot of us join together in wanting to do that public health study and regulation very well, regardless of whether or not you supported the legalization. I want to invest in exactly the work that Delegate Runyon and Delegate Bell just outlined. I think that where we differ is whether we think that the existing criminal penalties were helping or hurting. And I come from the corner that thinks that the criminal penalties weren't doing any good. And in fact, we're doing some harm. And I would like to invest in that health work on top of it. I should also say that one of the bills that I carried this session was a study to instruct the Crime Commission to review the current scope of addiction and substance abuse services across Virginia, not just for cannabis, but for some of those harder drugs that Delegate Bell described. Because I think right now we've got a lot of people who are getting the best substance abuse care that they can behind bars. And I think we have better options for that in an outpatient setting where we can really be treating addiction like the public health challenge that it is. And so I think that we can come together around that important public health work, no matter where we stand on the criminal parts.
And one more point. Chris Runyon said it was an 8,000 word bill. I'm one of the few people that had to review every mind numbing line of a 14,000 line bill. And that's exactly why we put a reenactment clause on it. We want to make sure we get it right to the extent that we can.
Thank you for the correction, Senator.
All right. Hey. Everybody's getting to get a second round at this one, so let the old country boy have a lick at it too now.
Most definitely, Delegate Ferris.
You know, Sally was mentioning there, and it's been a big talk with everybody, Senator Deeds, my friend from Bath County, and I understand the criminalization side to this, but I do remember, because I am on appropriations on the House side, that the governor put $1 million in the budget when he moved it to July the 1st, put $1 million in the budget to educate our youth and $1 million to educate the police. Again, I really think that educating the police on what we're doing now and what's acceptable and what isn't acceptable, it's going to be tough to get done. It's certainly going to be some confusion there. And that's why I wish we'd at least took another year to get some of this straight, maybe start the education part first.
Thank you. Appreciate that. We have time for one more question. If we use about 2 minutes each, I'm going to start this one with Senator Deeds. So everybody had a chance to have the question first. And coincidentally, this question is, we've seen a need for more mental health services during COVID. Will the state be enhancing mental health services? And if so, how?
You know, we worked very hard to enhance mental health services over the last number of years. And we passed legislation about through the budget about 4 or 5 years ago to begin the process of radically remaking community services through a program called Step Virginia to take the mandated services at every community service board from 2 to 10. I think we're going to try in the next budget to complete Step Virginia, to complete the implementation of that program. And during this pandemic, one of the main problems we've seen is that overcrowded hospital system has been even under more stress. Our facilities, when they get a case of COVID, when somebody with COVID as a patient or somebody who works there as COVID, that might shut down a wing or it might shut down a whole hospital, which has meant even a bigger crisis. People that are in crisis themselves sit in emergency rooms longer. So it's increased the stress on our system. We've not adequately responded to that stress in every situation. And so we are constantly working to try to figure out how to just do the things we're supposed to be doing. Over the long haul, we will build enhancements into the system, but we at this point, we still have a lot of shortcomings.
Yes, thank you, Senator Deeds. Delegate Ferris, mental health services.
Let me tell you something. This is a subject I love to talk about because I'm a diabetic. I'm pre-diabetic. And if I exercise and eat right, take my medicine, nobody knows it. But if I don't do right, then it affects me. But nobody thinks, I don't think in the community that anybody treats me any different if they know I'm a diabetic or not. And I think as a community, as a society, we have treated mental health awful. And I think it's something that we need to encourage people to live the lifestyle they need to live, to support them, make sure that they have the medication they need. And I think as a state, it's something we've got to do, give the support to those people that we need to support, that need it, get them the help they need it, and as a community, treat it like it is. It's an illness, and I think we all can live much much more pleasant lives, and it's something that I love to stress to people when I get the opportunity to talk about it. I went with a very dear friend of mine to a doctor's visit, and that doctor used that scenario of diabetes with him, and it was really eye-opening to me. I had been working with him, trying to get him to get the help he needed. And he told me I needed help too. So I just agreed that we just go to the doctor together. And that's what we did. And that's the way I really hope that as a society and as a community that we will treat mental health and make things go down that road much better than we have in the past.
Thank you. And now Delegate Bell for 2 minutes.
So I have to say some of the most edifying work I've done in the last 10 years has been in this space with Senator Deeds on his, again, I always say this, everybody calls it the Deeds Commission, but him, but on the Deeds Commission. And what we recently had a hearing, and we spend a lot of time at the emergency end of the equation, meaning what happens when somebody's picked up by law enforcement, put in the back of a car, taken to a hospital. And it's a problem and lots of reasons, but one of which would be the hospitals are full. And if you haven't heard the information we received, that they're bursting at capacity, COVID has made it worse. And then you just end up with a whole series of upstream consequences. The emergency room doesn't have a place to send somebody, so they stay in the ER. The deputies have to stay with them. They can't hand off to a secure site. And so it's not just stressing the mental health system. You have people being transported 5 hours to the nearest bed. It's stressing the health system, the law enforcement system, and of course it greatly impacts the care. I don't know that we can solve it at that end, but certainly what Senator Deeds was referring to, which would be to try to reach as many people as possible before they reach that moment of crisis. And we had we went on trips around the state visiting different facilities. One that I think certainly impressed me, and I think Cree, you've said it impressed you too, are these crisis stabilization units where someone, before they have to be taken in under force and in, you know, the back of a car, they realize they've been through the cycle before. And they can report themselves in, and they're staffed by a nurse practitioner, not a doctor. They're not locked down. You get three hots and a cot. You get your meds right. Maybe just a place that's quiet, and it can save someone from the inpatient hospital. It's not just better care. It gives them some agency over what happens. It saves a lot of money. These are not, you know, with all the lockdown facilities. I think things like that are going to be a continued emphasis going forward. We will always have to have the safety net below the safety net, but as few people that need it, the better. I do think that in terms of some of the smaller things we've been able to do, like making the transportation work better, trying to find supportive housing, they call them wraparound services, trying to realize that when people leave the jail, if they went in with mental health issues, if we don't connect them up with the community service boards, are missing a real opportunity. Those are all good things. I think COVID, in addition, made it harder to identify. So the school was often a place that children who had mental health issues were identified and were given services, not necessarily through the school, but that would be the connection point. I can assure you that the teachers would say that they just have not had the ability to see the kids as much. And perhaps the ones that weren't able to connect through Zoom were the very ones who needed the problems or needed the help. So with all of those, we're hopeful that as we come out, there will certainly be a need for the kind of services Cree was identifying, that we can do those. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Delegate Hudson?
Sure. I'm glad that Delegate Bell ended talking about our schools, because I think that is one of the places where we're really going to have to invest in the coming months. I mean, I think that we know that we have a lot of catch up to do in education with our children who have been so rocked by this year. But I think especially injecting our schools with more counselors and with more of those mental health services on site, the therapeutic day treatment, TDT programs that have been successful in places. And, you know, all of that is going to cost money. And we've got some help coming from the federal government, but I would really love to see the state step up in the year ahead and put the resources behind those programs, because we know they're being really successful. We hear such positive feedback about them from students and school administrators. And so we need to add to that continuum so that we're not waiting until something gets to a hospitalization kind of scenario. The other thing that I would stress, and I think y'all know I often come at things from a workforce angle, but there's a lot more that we can do to be supporting and retaining the very valuable professionals who are in these roles. I think, like so many folks in healthcare occupations, they were already stretched thin and being very burned out, and then COVID has only added on top of that. I think they're overdue for a raise for a lot of state support services. I think especially in a community like ours, where the reimbursement rates have not kept up with the cost of living in a very high priced place like Albemarle and Charlottesville. And so I think there's a lot more that the state needs to be doing to put resources behind these jobs so that they can become more sustainable for the long haul, because it's very, very difficult work. And we hear in talking with people every day that they feel, you know, personally burned out and under-supported. And then when somebody, you know, retires a little bit early, then the team is a little stretched thin and everybody else is stretched a little further. We're getting to a point where we've really worn our workforce thin in these critical professions. And there's a lot more we could do to have their back.
Thank you so much. And Delegate Runyon.
Thank you. You know, it's quite interesting because as I was making my notes, a number of these issues have been covered already. But to summarize, you know, we've got a fundamental capacity issue. And so we've got to improve that. We've got to make those available. In Augusta, at Augusta Health, they just opened a 26-bed facility that included an inpatient treatment center that included six for youth. And in talking with the folks that are doing that, you understand quickly how quickly that'll fill up, how, let's say, it's really an inadequate solution. It's not a complete solution. Appreciate that they're doing it, but we need more. We talked about improving the follow-up care. So it looks to me like if we commit the resources, if we prioritize our resources and address this stuff on the inbound, so or the preemptive side, and then make sure we provide adequate follow-up care, that that's going to give a significant improvement in the circumstances. I agree in chatting with the CSB folks in the Harrisonburg facility. You know, the Harrisonburg-Augusta market or region is a little different perhaps in Albemarle and Charlottesville, but certainly not in the rural parts of Albemarle. Folks struggle to receive adequate care. They struggle to get to a provider. They struggle, you know, we have limitations on transportation. We have limitations on access. And so I'm really excited when you talk to folks about the expansion, the expansive use of telehealth during the pandemic. And there, you know, a few bright spots that the pandemic's isolated, and that would be one. And when you talk to the mental health providers, they say, you know, there's some obstacles to overcome. It is not an easy thing, and there's some people that are very resistive to it, but they have seen significant success, at least here on this side of the Blue Ridge, with providing basic care, follow-up care, continuing care through the telehealth system. So it points to the need for resources in broadband. And I was pleased to see that we did that. But, you know, all this stuff works together. I think that was all about, I'm very supportive of STEP Virginia. When I first was elected, I spent a lot of time going through that and certainly would encourage the administration and the folks that run those areas to let's move forward with dispatch on that. There may be some areas that we need to adjust and create additional support, but let's make sure that we're moving forward and let's get to the end point on that because it's going to make lives all lives in the Commonwealth better. So I truly do appreciate you all.
Thank you all so much. And we only left one question on the table, so I was excited about that. But again, on behalf of Senior Statesmen of Virginia, thank you for taking time to prepare and to be here today. As many know, but in case you don't, this is recorded. So soon you'll be able to see it, get a link to it if you want on the Senior Statesmen of Virginia website. And we encourage you to do that because this is good, important information. And we definitely want everyone to know and to understand the great information you've shared. So thank you again on behalf of Senior Statesmen. And next month, to just continue the link of important topics, we will be hearing from Evan Fineman, Governor Northam's special advisor on broadband, about broadband and internet services and expansion in the Commonwealth of Virginia. So we hope to see you all again on June 9th. So thank you again.
Thank you, Ms. Friedman. We really appreciate it. And yes, Thank all the legislators. I really think we had a constructive conversation.
Applause to everyone. And of course, join the Senior Statesmen of Virginia if you're not already a member. Have a great day. Thank you.